Kaya, hello and welcome to The Agenda on RTRFM 92.1. Danielle Raphael with you in the chair for the next hour of talks and music from marginalised gender perspectives. And it's a pleasure to have your company this Tuesday, September 13. Big show today, but before we get stuck into it, a huge thanks to Tom Reynolds, as always, for today's edition of On The Record. You can restream the show on rtrfm.com.au or tune in live weekdays from 9am to 11am. And to Dylan for the news, we'll have another update at 12 for you. Today on the show, though, we'll be chatting with Melissa Roberts, journalist and editor of Through Her Eyes, a new book which documents some of Australia's most coveted female journalists, specifically those who cover conflict on the front lines. I'm super excited to hear more about that one. And we'll, of course, have our weekly chat with Celeste Rodriguez-Liro, our UWA senior lecturer and linguist on the Language Lab. But today we're going to be covering nonverbal communication and how that intersects with gender and sexuality. Super interesting. It always is interesting, but looking forward to catching up with Celeste today to chat more about that one. If you want to get in touch, as always, you can send me an SMS on 0405 921 921 or email in studio at rtrfm.com.au. You're tuned to The Agenda on RTRFM 92.1, and it's 11:30, which means Celeste is here to join us for the Language Lab today. And we often think of language as what is verbally communicated between parties, but a lot of communication is often nonverbal, as we know. Being able to read nonverbal cues is essential to being able to fully understand a speaker's implied and literal meaning. In today's episode of the Language Lab, we're going to be talking about how nonverbal language plays a part in daily communication and how it varies across genders. Celeste is with me now on the line to discuss. Hey, Celeste.
How are you?
Really good. Lovely to catch up as always. Now, let's just dive straight into it. Maybe an obvious question to start, but what's the importance of nonverbal communication when it comes to communicating with other people?
Yeah, sure. So I'll ask another question. So I'll answer your question with another question today. So have you ever felt, you and anyone listening to this, have you felt as though when you're on a video call, your video conferencing platform like Zoom or any of those, have you ever felt as though when the cameras are off, especially when the cameras are off, but even when they're on, have you ever felt as though you're not as good reading the room, so to speak?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, Celeste, because I, during COVID, had a period where I was teaching dance online, which is very, very tricky. All my props to the teachers out there that had to do it every day back to back. But it's interesting because I found it quite difficult personally, and it's also very hard to kind of gauge in terms of nonverbal communication, how people are feeling or, you know, what response they need to give. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I'm so happy you mentioned teaching, and I can't even begin to understand how difficult it must be to teach dance online.
That's next week's chat.
And you know, you have all of my respect for that. But when we teach things, even when we teach content in linguistics, when I teach online, it's the same thing. And the reason why it is so difficult to know if a student is following, if they are having difficulty, but also other things, you know, are you offending anyone? Are people bored? Things like that. What we are missing in the absence of a good camera, or even when the cameras are on, but there may not be, you know, we'll not be able to kind of read people's faces as accurately. We are missing nonverbal language, right? And nonverbal language is any form of communication that doesn't use words. And that includes all sorts of things: gestures, eye contact, facial expressions, body movements, tone of voice, right? So there are different ways that we can utter the same, you know, the same phrase, the same, grammatically speaking, you can utter the same thing. You know, it'll be the same thing, but then it'll come up as, you know, different tone of voice, different prosody, different pitch, and it can mean different things. And it can also happen when we look at sign languages, especially when we look at sign languages, because, of course, these are very much based on our vision and how we move our face and in our hands and things like that. So depending on how you use nonverbal language, you will be relaying different indirect cues to the listener. Yes, so you may be saying one thing and meaning another, basically. And that's what I mean by reading the room. Yeah, so someone can say to you, yeah, that was really well done. But you can see in their faces that maybe they're annoyed, or maybe they are sad, or they're disappointed. Or someone can say to you, that wasn't great. But you can see in their faces a glimmer of hope. And so that you're reading all of that at the same time. It's not just what people are saying, but also how they look and how they move when they're saying it. And we are embodied beings, and that's, we use all of us in communicating. So this is, fascinating area, nonverbal communication.
So fascinating. And the question it raises for me is, what might be more important, verbal or nonverbal? And maybe we can attempt to answer that at the end of this segment. But I wanted to jump into the intersection of gender now. How do the different genders vary in terms of nonverbal communication?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So basically, any linguistic competence that we develop throughout our lives is the result of socialization. So we're socialized into speaking in a certain way, not just in terms of the structure of what we say, but also how we say it. So generally speaking, if we go, we base this on the gender binary, males tend to use maybe less facial expressions, and they will tend to use less high pitch, and they will speak less frequently, or they may, if you're looking at two straight males interacting, they're likely to overlap less frequently as well, so that's all related. But also in terms of how they use their physical space, and whether there is a lot of touch or distance between people, their posture and their gestures. So generally speaking, men have been shown traditionally to use more directed movements with their hands, sharper movements, and potentially less hand movements accompanying whatever it is they're saying. And there's a huge one, which is eye contact, which can be used to challenge or sort of reinforce a certain power dynamic. But again, this is based on a binary. And so then if we assume that that is what men have traditionally been socialized into, then females will sort of do the opposite, which is use more facial expressions and use gestures in a way that tend to accompany in a very fluid way, maybe storytelling or whatever else is going on. They may choose less physical distance between women when women are interacting just by themselves. And I think this has come up before in this segment, that women tend to do a lot of the sort of really tiring work, not just in the home, etc., but also interacting with people and making people feel as though they're being listened to and they're being understood. Having said this, there is a huge elephant in the room, or at least two. One is, has any of these changed in terms of what other, what people of diverse gender identities are doing. And the other elephant in the room is, what is the interaction between these things that I've just described and cross-cultural differences? Because there are huge cross-cultural differences. And something as seemingly, you know, seemingly sort of innocent and not a big deal as eye contact can be really offensive. If you come from a culture where intense eye contact is welcome and expected, and you are speaking to someone where eye contact tends to be completely avoided, you can, there are countless examples of business deals actually falling through because the eye contact wasn't right. Very powerful again.
Absolutely. And it comes down to this idea of always seeing things through the Western lens. I know I've always been taught to make eye contact with people because it is polite. And at school and even at uni, you're taught this is like a basic rule of politeness, but it's not always the case. So really great to be mindful of that. We're tuned to The Agenda today here on RTRFM 92.1, and I'm with Celeste Rodriguez-Liro chatting today about nonverbal communication and how that intersects with gender. Celeste, if I may, it raises a really interesting question. I know you were talking before about, we were talking before about Zoom and the ability to gauge someone's response or perhaps interest in a certain topic if you're chatting or maybe teaching online. And we said how women perhaps, women socially are often wanting to be more liked, and so that's why maybe they're using more facial expressions in terms of their nonverbal communication. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, that sort of aligns with this idea, what you were just mentioning, that women will, generally speaking, and again, it really depends on what the hierarchy you're looking at is, and where people sit in terms of, you know, who's the teacher, who's the student, who's the boss, who's the employee, things like that. But generally speaking, women will tend to have a communication style that will be about finding a lot of common ground and making people feel as though this is a safe place for you to express whatever it is you want to express. Having said that, then a lot of women sort of drop that as they enter leadership roles because still there is such a bias in favor of males occupying those roles that it seems as though the way we understand leadership, you know, how is leadership actually embodied and accomplished, still very masculine. But there will come a time, we expect, I hope, a time where leadership will be completely normalized to have leaders who are very empathetic and who are good listeners and who will completely take on board whatever it is anyone has to contribute. It worries me when at meetings, junior people are completely ignored. Mm-hmm. And this happens a lot. And I think a more feminine style, you know, it's okay, we need to get things done, but it really is about listening and about being able to read the room. And I'm not saying that women are the only ones who are good at this. I mean, there's no basis for that. But as a general rule, women have been hanging out in groups and collaborating for longer than men. And so it could be that's just one of the reasons.
Celeste, as always, we could talk forever about this stuff. It's super fascinating, but we'll cap it there. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Celeste Rodriguez-Liro from the University of Western Australia, our resident linguist here at The Sound Alternative, chatting today about nonverbal communication and how that intersects with gender. If you're enjoying the topics here on Language Lab, we'd love to open up the opportunity for you to send your requests for future segments. You can drop us a line on 0405 91 91 or email us studio@rtrfm.com.au. Let us know what topics you'd like to hear in the coming weeks. From the ruins of Hiroshima to the battlefields of Syria, Afghanistan and now Ukraine, Australia's women correspondents have changed the way the world's conflicts are reported and understood in what is often a male-dominated sphere. Now, in the recent release, Through Her Eyes, Australia's leading women journalists, many of them still on the front line, tell their stories of life as a correspondent, the risk, the drama and the suffering they witness, as well as the joy they feel when a headline does make a difference. Journalist and editor of Through Her Eyes, Melissa Roberts, joins us now on The Agenda. Melissa, good morning.
Good morning.
Or maybe good afternoon from where you are.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
Thank you so much for joining us on The Agenda today. I wanted to start off with maybe a general question, but something I think is important to kind of frame the conversation today. What is the role of a war correspondent generally, and why send journalists off to the front line at all?
Well, look, it's really important to have people overseas reporting on the world from a perspective that is shared by Australians, not relying on foreign nationals to tell us what they see and how they see it. We need Australians in foreign countries, in countries all around the world, on war zones, but also in peaceful areas or in areas of various kinds of turmoil and upheaval, to see what's going on, to tell us the story, to write the first draft of history, but with us in mind. And I guess that is really one of the reasons why I wanted to do this book, because historically it was a man's game and you were pretty much white, middle class, middle-aged and a guy in order to get tapped to go and do the big stories. And women had to really struggle to be sent overseas as foreign correspondents for an organisation. Days now, of course, it's just that correspondents are just as likely to be women as men. But we need people from all kinds of backgrounds, not just the standard male correspondent, not just women correspondents either, but people who represent a whole group of different ethnic backgrounds, Australians from different backgrounds. It'd be really valuable.
Absolutely. And as you said, representation is so important. And that's what the book's all about, shining a light on those wonderful perspectives. You spoke there about your drive behind writing this book. I'm wondering if you could dive into what drove the women in this story or this compilation of stories that you've written.
Well, originally, it was very difficult for women to be journalists, even through a lot of the 20th century. Women were generally confined to the women's pages. They were giving household tips and telling you how to clean the carpet more effectively or cook the dinner for your husband. And it was really, really difficult. A hard-hitting journalist, women had to make their own way to the story. And that kept going right up until the 80s. So people who paved their way to the front was like Kate Webb, who was an Australian. She went on to be UPI bureau chief in Cambodia during the Vietnam War. And quite famously, she was captured by the North Vietnamese and declared dead and surprised everybody when she walked out of the jungle.
Wow.
But she had to pay her own way there because she wasn't satisfied with being back in Melbourne and wearing white gloves to cover society weddings. Diane Willman, who worked for the ABC as a freelancer, she had to pay her own way to Lebanon. Freelancer covering the Lebanon Civil War in the early 70s. She went on to have a baby while she was there, and she put under a mattress and keep working as the bombs fell. So there were a lot of women who made their own way to do a story. It wasn't until really the mid-80s when the ABC sent Helene Chung as their first woman that they posted overseas.
An incredible story, that one, especially that it does intersect with culture too. And it's amazing that, you know, it's perhaps taken this long for those experiences to be reported on. I feel like, as you mentioned, you know, the pop cultural experience is very much masculine and one that it often excludes people who don't necessarily identify with that. Can you tell us about the transition from the image of what we have today? Where did the inclusion of other journalists kind of start in the war zone?
Well, we now have, fortunately, quite a lot of really good, really excellent foreign correspondents who are not necessarily from an Anglo background. There are some women who have written for our book, Yara Boumelham, who is, her family is originally from the Middle East. Dia Hadid, she grew up in Western Sydney, but her family had originally come from Lebanon. And they can bring another layer of insight into what we learn about people in these conflict zones. Dia wrote a story about the Gaza Strip. She covered the Gaza Strip a lot at a time when it was very dangerous for foreign journalists. And despite being an Australian, she had a bit of a free pass because she and she lived in the Gaza Strip, and she covered this story about how the ordinary people of Gaza just want things that the rest of us want. They want relationships, a family, a happy life. And while Gaza was under the control of Hamas, which most of us recognise as a terrorist organisation, they also take care of every aspect of people's lives there, from birth through to funerals. And they set up a Lonely Hearts Bureau. So Dia did these interviews with women who had gone to the matchmaker to find a husband and a life partner, and living under this incredible bombardment and blockade. And it's a very moving story. So that's the sort of story that, you know, you have to have some pretty good context and some pretty deep understanding to be able to get.
And the book does cover all of that and more. You're listening to The Agenda, and we're with Melissa Roberts today, journalist and editor of Through Her Eyes, a documentation featuring some of Australia's most coveted female journalists who cover conflict on the front lines, which can be dangerous work, especially when you're covering conflicts like you mentioned, those in Gaza and others abroad, events which do bring nations together on the world stage. What do you think is the importance of documenting these conflicts through the experiences of women specifically?
Well, I feel that women have really changed the way that journalism is conducted. They've changed our correspondence. I mean, we were talking about back in World War II when women could rarely get to the front. Australian women were pretty much banned from covering what you might call the action or the dangerous fighting. They could not go any closer to the front than a nurse would go. So the stories that they did were the stories of the nurses, the stories of the wounded soldiers, but also the stories of the local people who were affected by these great winds of change in the world. And so they had been confined to what people sort of sneeringly called the soft stories, but they dug deep and they found some really fascinating stories about real people living through this. And I think that gradually that has changed the way that all foreign correspondents approach their work now. And male and female, all correspondents tend to think about the real people who are being affected by these massive changes. I think of the story that we have now in the Ukraine, where we're much more interested in the story of the people sheltering in a basement than the kind of munitions that are passing down on them that sent them there. It's a much more people-oriented business now. I put that down to the fact that it is a much more diverse crew.
Absolutely. We do often think that the hard news stories, well, we have historically thought that the hard news stories are the most reputable, perhaps. But I don't know, for me, it's always been the emotional side of things. And it's really interesting and fascinating to hear that it was the introduction of women that maybe spurred that on in the mainstream news cycle. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today on The Agenda to chat all about this new book, Through Her Eyes, and all the stories that come with it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been great.
That was Melissa Roberts, journalist and editor of Through Her Eyes, a book detailing the stories of women on the front line of war. Really interesting stuff. The book is out now if you'd like to go grab it.